Hello, and welcome to Just Around the Corner with Dennis Mansfield, a podcast focused on culture, history, travel, and even a little entertainment from time to time. I hope you enjoy traveling with me and with my guests, my clients, friends on each episode. Today's episode is a bit different. I've invited my son, Colin Mansfield, to turn the tables on me and interview his old man about life and the things that moved and molded me. Now, as a business coach, podcaster, and author, I invite you to subscribe to my newsletter by clicking onto my website at dennismansfield.com and hit the button on the landing page. I think you'll like that too. I'm Dennis Mansfield.
Thank you for joining Just Around the Corner with Dennis Mansfield. As John Hay, one of the most famous men of the 19th century, once said, all the great prizes in life are just around the corner. Let's go there together.
Welcome to Just Around the Corner with Dennis Mansfield. I am not Dennis Mansfield, but I am related to him. And I am joined today by Dennis Mansfield. That's how you doing, Dad?
Good, Colin. It is rare to hear my name that many times at the entrance of this particular podcast.
Yes. But
this episode is a special one, and it's really one of two.
Yes, one of two. I am your host today, Colin Mansfield. We have flipped the script. And today I'm going to be interviewing my dad about many things. And here's the fun part, is that he does not know what questions are coming his way.
I'm not seeing a single one.
Yeah.
Don't know.
So I'm going to
protect ready.
This over this way so there's no prep involved. So this is going to be a very fun two-part episode. We're going to start today actually by just talking about some things about your life, about your faith, and then in the second episode, we'll talk through some other things like business. So is there anything you wanted to say just to kick things off?
Well, I can tell you that I've been in media and in public policy and in business for four decades plus. And I've been interviewed on CBS, Fox News, NBC, all over. But I've never been interviewed by you. And so this is a really kind of a fun thing for me. And I'm thinking, yeah, let's do this.
I was giving my dad some tips. You know, you always put your hands right in the four corners like you would on the news and talk like this.
As if I was a newbie.
Yeah. little green behind the ears there. Yeah. I actually wanted to kick things off with a little bit of a throwback today. Mm-hmm. You grew up as an Air Force brat. And it's not something that you often talk about, I think, in public, though you've certainly told me a lot about it. I want to know, how did growing up as an Air Force brat shape your early as a child, your outlook on life? And do you think that that has maybe impacted how you have the decisions you've made going to West Point, some of the other things in your early life?
Oh, that's great. I've never been asked that question. So you're
off to a good start.
You're starting with a nice hit. Growing up as the third of seven Air Force brats under dad, mom, grandma, and grandpa, Bill and Virginia Mansfield, really gave me a sense of confidence, because for anybody that was a military dependent as a kid, you knew that once you were on the base, you were taken care of. Mm-hmm. In other words, the military police, or in the Air Force, the air police, were there and they watched over the kids. So there weren't, and there still aren't to today, cases where oddballs come in and take kids, or kids are hurt or anything. So I grew up with a confidence and a security that was remarkable. And really, when you're in my case, an Air Force brat, the thought was, look at all these cool things these people have provided for a playground for me. And
statues of planes.
Absolutely. Only they were real planes. Yeah. And we would go to the tarmac and we would see them. And where we lived in particular in Texas was Randolph Air Force Base. Lived all over the world. Lived in Germany. Lived all over. But the tarmac issue, the idea of the playground issue, being the third of seven, I was the middle child that had fun going to the tarmac, mm-hmm. and going to the rope line. You see, in the 60s, when I was a kid, that was the time of Senator Lyndon Johnson, who then became Vice President Lyndon Johnson, who then became President Lyndon Johnson, always flying into the tarmac that was about maybe 800 feet from my house. So I would go over there and I would stand in the rope line and I'd see the president or the Senate, depending. But Johnson always had an amazing amount of historical people. It's like watching a Mount Rushmore where everybody moved and were alive, except for some of the old guys. They were still alive, but they didn't move much. So I felt like I was watching Mount Rushmore. But I grew up seeing these guys and realizing that, Hubert Humphrey was just a guy, that Mike Mansfield was just a guy, that these names that were on the news every night were just people. Mm-hmm. And I think it instilled in me a sense of, so politics is just people. Mm-hmm. Okay, I get that. And as a little kid, I didn't treat them in any way, shape, or form other than, people that I would meet on the street. So that gave me a firm foundation of celebrities, nah. Politicians, national, nah. These are just guys that are getting off airplanes, doing jobs.
That's really interesting, and I feel like as a kid growing up around not only people that either were famous or would become famous, but also being around a lot of people in uniform probably made you very comfortable. Would you say that's true around you've met so many people throughout your life who maybe some would think, oh, those are very important, they must be very uptight. But there's a certain level of humanity when you get past the outer surface or the uniform. Would you say that's true?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, I remember some of the greatest times as a Air Force brat was realizing that we could go to the officers' quarters where generals lived for Halloween and get the best candy because they were the wealthy military guys. And I remember times where I'd meet guys and they'd, hey, Denny, how you doing? And then later I'd see them and they'd have 2 stars as generals. Yeah. And I remember thinking later as I did go to West Point and met generals and, Secretary of States and different people that came, speakers of the House of Representatives, I would always just move towards that issue of seeing the humanity in them. So it gave me a foundation that was really solid without being starstruck and yet appreciating the position, not over indulging in the personality.
Sure. No, that makes a lot of sense. We're gonna fast forward a little bit because we could talk a lot about West Point, but I think you've talked a lot about your time at West Point.
Over the years, I have,
I think. I want to fast forward to you, and this is around the same time, but you meeting Mom.
Yeah.
And I want to ask you, I have some questions tangentially, but first I just want to ask you to, if you could share the story of how you met Mom, because I think it's a lovely story.
Thank you. Well, I had dated a fine young lady for 4 years. Through high school and into West Point. And I think we both, as often is the case with a high school girlfriend or a college girlfriend, you realize that the things that you had in common, not so much anymore. And we were towards the end of our relationship. We weren't angry with each other. We just realized that we were growing apart. Mm-hmm. And along with a dear friend, Ray Acha, decided to go out to have some ice cream. Mm-hmm. And I think my girlfriend even suggested, hey, there's a great little ice cream place. May have been Ray. I didn't know this place existed. It was called Swenson's, and it was in the city of West Covina in Southern California. So we went in, and we sat down. And the waitress came up and was just very kind and giving and loving, a very lovely lady. And I remember thinking at the time that this is the kind of person that I would have a great conversational life with, a fun time with, and therefore engaged in conversation. Mm-hmm. Well, that, of course, was Susan, your mom, my bride, because I met her. She couldn't tell whether I was actually even dating the young lady. Apparently,
That ship had already sailed.
Ice formed on the right. I don't know. But she loved talking with Ray, loved talking with me, and certainly was kind and gracious to the young lady. But I decided I've got to go back and meet whoever this young person is. What I didn't know was, yes, as we developed a very quick and whirlwind relationship, she later told me, after I had asked her to marry me, that as she walked up to the table, she heard a voice that said, basically, you know, this is who you're going to marry. And her response was, I wonder if I am going to marry this guy.
What did I eat now?
This ice cream is great. So sweet. And so there was a mystical quality that did move quickly. I met Mom in January of that particular year of 1977. I asked her to marry me in July mm-hmm. of 77. By November of 77, we were married. Mm-hmm. And as a result of that, every Christmas we've ever had as a couple, we've had as a married couple. And so when you think about the holidays and November, of course, being the month that we were married in, was also her birthday. Mm. And so I had to marry her before her birthday so that we were both the same age.
Gotcha.
As I like to say, she was way older than me. She was like 6 weeks older than me. And I just didn't want, you know, the songs from Mrs. Robinson.
Yeah.
I didn't want the sound of cougars in the background. You know what I mean?
Okay. Here's something that I've had to, you know, I grew up just knowing. Obviously, faith is very important to our family, always has been. But for you and Mom, as an early married couple, of course, you were raised Catholic. Mm-hmm. As an early married couple, you were not, and maybe you weren't Christians is a hard spin to take on it, but you certainly weren't really involved in any churches. You maybe believed in Christ in a sort of ethereal way, but I'm very curious, and I think it's something that will segue nicely into some other questions that we have later on. But what was it like marrying, falling in love with somebody, establishing maybe some early traditions and having your own sort of getting your rhythm down as a couple, mm-hmm. Being non-Christians, mm-hmm. and then coming to the Lord, mm-hmm. and those having to change, or perhaps there having to be new ones in addition to the old ones? What was that like?
Well, there's a great scene in a movie, Field of Dreams, mm-hmm. where the Kevin Costner character is communicating to his brother-in-law that he built the big field for invisible ghosts mm-hmm. that are out there. And of course, the brother-in-law is thinking to himself, what are you, nuts?
Right.
And yet, when Kevin Costner's character's daughter chokes on a hot dog, one of the ghosts who later became a doctor steps out to save the life of right. the child. And the brother-in-law looks up and sees all of the players. Mm-hmm. And he goes, what? When do they arrive? What's going on? Did anybody know about this? Mm-hmm. Well, that's how I felt when I came to know Christ. I knew about Christ and had grown up in a religious mm-hmm. Family. But I had never grown up in a relational family mm-hmm. where the name of Jesus was completely revered, that what Christ did for us on the cross was clear and precise and personal.
Right.
So when that happened, I felt like that guy in the movie. Does anybody else know about this? Mm-hmm. Because it was literally like things falling from my eyes. And I realized, A, you know, Susan and I made the decision there'd be no divorce because we came from divorced families, mm-hmm. But she hedged on the issue of homicide. And so
we'll flip a coin.
Yeah, and I probably gave her reason to. I was just a selfish brat of a boy in men's clothing. And when I surrendered my life to Christ, the two things of our lives became the one thing of our heart. And instead of just living life out loud, we were enjoying the life of a man and a wife who realized that there were three strands of the rope mm-hmm. that held us together. There was Susan, there was me, and there was the Lord. Mm-hmm. And those three strands are unbelievably tough to break. So we did walk away going, wow! And though the first 2 years of our marriage were beautiful in the sense and lovely in the sense of newlyweds, they were also very difficult. Mm-hmm. And it hasn't been that the years since, and, you know, we have been married many, many years, as you know, have been less difficult. They've just been better to deal with. Mm. We have the tools that are involved in the Bible, the B-I-B-L-E, the basic instructions before leaving Earth, that have helped me go, oh, that's what it means to be tender, kind-hearted, forgiving one another, just as God in Christ forgave Dennis. Mm-hmm. Those sorts of things.
It's very interesting. When you met the Lord, I mean, what a shift of not just, like you said, the kind of scales falling off of your eyes and changing your own perception, but what a shift in learning how to treat other people.
Yeah.
You had mentors in your early faith and then all throughout your Christian walk. What do you feel is the impact of mentorship in regards to being a Christian, but also in regards to just life in general? What is the impact of mentorship? Is it something that everybody can get value out of? Mm. Is it something that you feel like was essential to you? Mm. Or is it like an optional thing that it's nice to have a mentor?
Well, I would say that the element that struck me the deepest was the confidentiality of having a mentor, someone that I could go to who met with me on a regular basis to both pray with me. And there's something about the intimacy of prayer together that a man or a woman's heart can be melded with another man or a woman for the purpose of getting the deepest things that you're dealing with, that you and I would be dealing with. When you were little, I used to pray with you on a regular basis. And we'd do Bible studies, and there was a sweetness of seeing you as a little version of you grow into a young man who loved God. Same thing with a mentor to me. Mine was a man named Peter Gosdick. And Peter took time to meet with me. The confidentiality end of it was that I could pour myself out. I think it's the essence of why all Christian traditions have confession as a part of the, you know, constructs of what it means to walk in a different way. And to be able to confess the errors of your ways and be encouraged to walk differently.
Be challenged even.
Oh, totally be challenged. And not be defensive. I think most of us live in a world of defensiveness. Oh, you don't need to bring that up. Well, actually, they do need to bring it up. And I, as a person or another individual, needs to be challenged by it. So I think that was it.
Let's talk about masculinity for a second. Because growing up in a Air Force household, having gone to West Point, having been raised and seen all of these very manly men, your dad maybe chief among them. How did you look at masculinity different, or did you maybe initially? How have you looked at masculinity different over the years after meeting the Lord? When you look back on your early life, how did that change?
Well, I think all of us, going back to your mentorings, are mentored either purposely or accidentally. And so oftentimes the accidental mentoring comes from what we see on television or movies. Maybe even sometimes by someone that we see off to the side in our life, but normally TV or movies. And so the idea of a John Wayne, the idea of a Kirk Douglas, a Steve McQueen, Robert Redford, would be sort of an iconic image of what manliness was. What I found, however, was that when I became a follower of Christ, I think I began to see words jump off the pages of the Bible where he described himself as meek and lowly. And I thought, this is the creator of the universe, the one who didn't discover it, but made it. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of people discovered stuff. Mm-hmm. But this is the man who made it. He's a creator. Considered meek in lowliness, something. Wow. When am I not meek? When am I not meek? And when am I not lowly? It's normally when I'm an arrogant buffoon, mm-hmm. when I think I'm something, and I want to pretend as though I am towards, for the benefit of someone's adoration or support or whatever. And then I have to go, no, transparency is a part of it. Being vulnerable is a part of it. You can't think you're a big shot when you're laying on the ground. Mm-hmm. You can't do it. And so those vulnerability and transparency became key to it.
Well, and I know you were involved in, especially in the, I think about it as the way, way past of the 80s and 90s.
long time
ago. Long time ago. After Meg and Nate, my older brother and sister came around, I mean, you were involved in ministries even when I was young and before I was born, like Promise Keepers, mm-hmm. that were not just focused on how to become a better Christian, but focus on how to become a good Christian man, a better Christian man.
Yeah.
And really, my understanding at that time especially was not in a some sort of pat on the back, you know, we're all in it together, but in a very challenging way, in a way mm-hmm. calling you to a greater purpose. Mm-hmm. I've always thought that that's something that's unique about Christianity and about men in Christianity, I think when it's done well, mm-hmm. is calling men to a higher purpose and sort of even reshaping perhaps what masculinity can look like. On that note, Christian trends, I thought this might be interesting. So there's always some cool new thing happening in Christianity some big big pastor or big worship leader or, you know, we were talking about the famous people, and Christianity certainly has its own, you know, brand of that.
Yeah.
You might have to think about this for a minute, so I don't want you to just jump in. Think about it. What are some of the Christian trends or Christian isms that either you followed in your young days and then looking back, you're like, gosh, that was silly, or things that you've had to place to the side on purpose, just going, that was a good season, but this is now.
Mm-hmm. That is a tremendous question. and the reason why is that culture exists, and then there's subculture that exists.
Yeah.
And in the evangelical world, in the charismatic world of Christianity, in the media-driven world of Protestantism, what you find and what I found was that there were these things that popped up. For example, there was a man named Keith Green. Keith Green was a recording artist in the late 70s when Mom and I came to know Christ. Mm-hmm. He was a radical John the Baptist kind of guy. Mm-hmm. He'd been as a youth, he had been an entertainer in Hollywood, and there was a choice of either Donny Osmond or Keith Green to become the next teen heartthrob. Well, Donny Osmond got the job. Keith Green went off to the side and became a has-been at age 11.
Gosh.
Yeah, and so he became a drug addict and just a dirtbag until he got hosed down and washed off by Jesus. Mm-hmm. And then it was a radical conversion. And then he started pounding out music. And it was hardcore. You know, get right or get left. Mm-hmm. And he'd call out people like you'd almost expect a bad football coach who won games, okay?
Yeah.
And yet, I was attracted to that because it was a virile masculinity mm-hmm. approach to, come on, you hypocrites. You say you love Jesus and you act like hell. Come on. Mm-hmm. You say you love the Bible and yet you're having sex with your girlfriend. Mm-hmm. You're not living with her. Oh, really? Well, come on.
Yeah.
And I developed that sharpness to my call. And I was always at odds with Christ's gentleness internally. Because
I was going to say, how did you actually think through that at the time when you heard passages on meek and lowly? The part of you must have been like,
there were moments, especially in that virileness of my Christianity that I was like, okay, we're supposed to be warriors for God. Right. Warriors carry swords. Swords cut limbs.
Right.
That's just the way
it
is.
It. You
know? And in time, I think my zeal became arrogance.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was perfect timing to go in the ministry.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, what? Yeah, let's go in and conquer there. And just a matter of a few years, I was involved in Focus on the Family and in other trendy things.
Lay out the timeline here. So Keith Green was about when for you, when you got in?
70s, and he passed away in 82 in a plane crash.
Okay.
In 82, I worked with kind of a interesting thing. I decided, you know what, let's have concerts. So I put concerts together in Southern California, where we lived at the time. Mm-hmm. And I worked with the Snyder family, who were the founders of In-N-Out Hamburgers. And they were very interested. Yes, let's get more people to concerts and let's do this. So I decided, which was a huge amount of money at the time, to put up $10,000 and bring in a couple of Christian groups to a place in San Bernardino and let's get this thing going. Let's rock this house.
Mm-hmm.
And open the doors suitable for, I guess, 6,000 or 7,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
And 1,000 people showed.
Oh, man.
And I remember standing in the sidelines going, I'm screwed. Because we were going to take an offering.
Yeah.
And an average offering at that time was about $3 a person. And so, you know, 6,000, that's 18,000. That would cover the cost.
Sure.
We paid all the bills, did all the stuff. And yet the Lord took that loss right from the start to say, is it okay to not be cool?
Yeah.
And do the things that work? Because out of that 1,000 people that showed up, about 800 of them had never heard the gospel.
Yeah.
And my mentor, Tom Harris, who led me to Christ, was the speaker, and he led them all to Christ.
Your perception of success changes.
Completely.
When it's not just about money and numbers.
Completely.
And it's about hearts.
And yeah. I went, yeah, I could do this.
Mm-hmm.
I could. And that started the breaking of the edges of the hardness of me.
And that was what year again?
That would have been right at 83, 84.
Okay.
And as a result of that, I went in, got a partner in business, Woody Wood, and he and I decided we'd go in and work on construction stuff. And
mm-hmm.
the very first thing we were given was the concert,
mm-hmm.
of all things. And it was to develop this place, Glen Helen Regional Park. And here Woody was a solid Christian, and I was a growing Christian.
Mm-hmm.
And we started a company, and the first people to hire us were Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak, and they wanted to put on the US Festival.
Mm-hmm.
And we went, okay. We didn't even know what it was. It was like the, I don't know, the rock event of the 80s, the high tech things,
yeah.
You know, and Apple did it. And so suddenly I had this fabulous success in business.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember, this is so great. A, never take me to a horse race, and B, never count on me winning the lottery, okay? I went up and the band that was playing, I remember turning to my friend Woody, my partner Woody, business partner, and I said, Woody, this is crazy. Just like that. And he goes, what? I go, look at this. This is a band from Ireland, of all places, with a stupid name.
Mm-hmm.
U2. They're going nowhere. They're going nowhere, man. And Woody said, well, don't be so harsh on your judgment. Well, anyway, at one of literally U2's first concerts and put it on. And that was fun. That was kind of like, wow.
So let's do it. We're going to do another fast forward here, because I wanted to focus this conversation around a faith. And I think for you, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but when we think about the rhythm of Dennis Mansfield's life and the major sort of inflection points, there's, I think in all of our lives, points that all kind of do this, and then there's long stretches that are life, mm-hmm. right? And that really is raising families and having kids and doing soccer games and being sports coaches and all of that, which is real life.
Mm-hmm.
what I want to do is, in terms of faith, from the outside looking in, I think the next major, and perhaps the most recent major change for you in terms of faith was when my brother Nate died. Certainly, I think for all of us, the biggest challenge to all of our faiths in different ways of our lives. I remember you saying something around the time after he died, and you've referred back to it just in our conversations, and I think it is a good point. You said, going through the grief, this is either my faith is real now or it's not. There was this binary decision, right? This or binary choice of I can either, and you do have to choose. It's not something that gets chosen for you. You have to choose, right? Of either I believe actually what I've been doing now for, you know, since I was a young married man for most of my life, most of my grown life, or I don't, and this is all fake, and I'm a fraud, right? Could you talk about that choice? And this is going to be our kind of cliffhanger going into episode two, right? But could you talk about that choice a little bit? And for you, how did that rock your foundation? And what allowed you to dive further into your relationship with God?
Wow. The day that Nate died, you and I were together. Mm-hmm. You saw me get the news. And it was like a shotgun blast against me that you would see in a Hollywood movie. Mm-hmm. And I hit the wall and I crumbled. And I remember at that moment on the floor sobbing and yet knowing this is a moment in time that has to be addressed by me, for me, to God. And I stood up and I purposely said, come on, everybody, get together. Mm-hmm. And you, your sister Meg, Caleb, her husband, Mom, and I huddled like you would see in a rugby scrum. Mm-hmm. And I said, this doesn't try our faith. This proves our faith. Mm-hmm. And we will rejoice in the God who gave me my son, you, your brother. We will rejoice in the fact that he never didn't have his hand on Nate Mansfield. Mm-hmm. He always had Nate in the palm of his hand and always knew where he was and was there the moment he died. Mm-hmm. Now almost 15 years ago. And when I did that, it was an act of sheer volition, mm-hmm. of purposeful action and attitude that I had never planned on, I had never anticipated. But because of this backdrop of decades of knowing every day that if this day was my last day, I will have lived it fully for Jesus Christ. Mm-hmm. And that if I could live that in my own life, I could see that when I saw the end of my own firstborn child's life. And it was in that that God met me and healed me of what could have been deep and agonizing pain that was full of what ifs, mm-hmm. or where were you,
right.
or any of those things. No, Christ is real. And if God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son, that whoever would believe in him would not perish but have everlasting life, then how is that truth applied to me losing my firstborn?
Right.
And it was, faith is the evidence of things not seen. It's the substance of things hoped for. Mm-hmm. And if that's the case, and the Bible says that without faith, it's impossible to please God. At that moment in time, I took a stake and nailed it into the ground with tethered to my soul. And I said, this is where I am. I will not be moved.
Well, and what I appreciate about that, kind of linking in some of what we talked about, is that decision was born, like you said, out of a, it wasn't one decision. That was many decisions leading up to a decision to go, I'm going to dive deeper in. It was also leadership for our family, right? And it was that, the essence of like positive masculinity steeped in Jesus coming forward at the time where it's needed most.
Correct.
I think this is where we're going to wrap it up, even though this is a really good conversation, because I want to tie this into how all of this faith that we've talked about in the next episode and all of your life from a young boy to a grown man who was pretty red-faced and could get very angry to being that but now a Christian to being not that and learning the value of like you were saying, meek and humble, and how can these things all marry together? What I want to do in the next episode is I want to talk about how has that impacted the day-to-day, all that in between we talked about. How has that impacted as a businessman, as a coach, as a mentor yourself? And to sort of tie this into the viewer of how all of us have stories, right? We all have our own story, and we all know the stories of our parents, of our grandparents, of our families. And I think what's interesting is to, as you peel that onion back, to learn more about other stories teaches you more about yourself. So what I would encourage everybody to do on the topic of ending on the topic of my brother, Nate, is read my dad's book, Beautiful Nate, because Beautiful Nate is perhaps the best dive into what does it look like to be a Christian man and a Christian parent, and to do that well and to do that poorly, and all the messiness that comes with it. And it's very honest and it's very real, as just as you've been today. So thank you, Dad. We'll come back next time and talk more.
Thanks.
I love you.
I love you, buddy.
This is pretty fun.
It is.